welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I am joined by an author who has written a young adult thriller that literally had me up all night, and I am worried that I am too tired of this interview, but I'm going to truck through anyway. So thank you for coming to the show. Welcome. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I am Stacey Stokes. I'm the author of The Darkness Rises. It is about a girl named Whitney who can see dark clouds hovering over strangers' heads, warning when they are in danger. And all her life, she has tried to help people until one day she saves a boy from her school and he goes on to do something pretty horrific. And so the book takes place a year later when she's trying to put that behind her, trying to ignore the dark clouds hovering over people's heads, which of course she can't do. And then somebody discovers her secret and they are out for revenge.
Yeah, it is so gripping. It's so engaging. And before we get into it too much, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your journey to the book. When did you start writing? And what was the inception point for this project?
Yeah. Well, I'll start with the inception point for it. I find with my books, there's always just like a weird moment of inspiration. I wish I could tell you what triggers it, but sometimes it comes out of nowhere. Sometimes it's from like a line in a book or a TV. And this one was just a line that came out of nowhere. I was cleaning my apartment and I just heard this voice in my head say, I was seven the first time I saw the darkness. And I was like, whoa, what was that? What is the darkness? And that's where the concept came from. It took me a long time to really find the rest of the details of the story, but that initial idea was over a decade ago. And I started writing the book. It was a very different book. This one took me a long time to figure out what was it going to be beyond just, I love this notion of a girl who could, the power that, that she could see dark clouds, that she had this provocation to save people, and that sometimes that saving people got her into trouble. I wrote a draft of it. I queried it. It did not go well because the book was not ready for an agent, let alone publication. I ended up setting it aside, writing what became my debut that came out 2 years ago called Remember Me Gone, also a speculative, I'd say more of a speculative mystery than a thriller, but a little bit of the thriller bend mm-hmm. about a girl whose family runs a memory-taking business in a border town in Texas, very similar to where I grew up in Texas. So that book went on, got published, and I had this dusty draft of The Darkness Rises and pulled it out, showed some chapters to my editor, and she thought the concept was great. So I started really reworking it to be the second book that now I'm very happy to say I love the shape that it's taken, the direction that it took, even though it took a long time to get here.
That's so interesting that it had such a long gestation period, because those 10 years too were, had massive changes for what the experience of being a teen is, I think, in America. And this book really engages with a lot of like extremely contemporary issues and things that affect like, yeah, the lives of like young teens in this country. I'm very glad you brought up your previous book, because I think what they both do really well is to use those kind of like speculative fiction elements to express like what the teen experience is like. So could you talk a little bit about what drew you to like the YA demographic and like perhaps this sort of like mystery slash thriller storytelling?
Yeah, I think the mystery thriller comes from my mom. Growing up, she was a huge book reader. We always had books in the house. She left them laying all over tabletops. She was never without a book. She used to have folded up paperbacks in her purse. And if we were waiting in line at the grocery store, she would pull it out and start reading. But Stephen King was her favorite author. And she often would not only read his books, but reread them. So there were a lot of terrifying Stephen King books lying around. And I was always told not to look at them, which, you know, is exactly what you should never tell a child. Because of course I wanted to look at them. And I peeked inside it. I peeked inside Carrie, you name it. And I probably looked inside of it. And it was one of those, like, they scared the ever-loving crap out of me, but also fascinated me. So that was kind of my first, there is something really compelling about stories that have some sort of supernatural or magical component. And then when I was in elementary school, I want to say like fifth or sixth grade, I discovered the young adult section of the bookstore. And not to date myself, but at the time, the hot authors were Christopher Pike and R.L. Stine. And I will never forget, I got my mom to buy me the book Chain Letter by Christopher Pike. And it blew my mind because I did not know that there were books like that written for me. I thought it either had to be terrifyingly adult books like Stephen King or it was Nancy Drew. And here was this book that was wonderful and perfect for me. And I gobbled up all of them for many, many years. And so I think that's really what clung to me is that notion of here is a book for me. And at the same time, that's really when I started to write and explore stories because I was so inspired by the stories I was reading that it stuck with me. So young adult has always been the age that I've written. I think from that just tender moment of finding that love of books for me and myself. And all of my stories have always had something weird in them. I have yet to write just a straight contemporary story where something's not a little bit askew. So it goes all the way back to Stephen King, but also thank you, Christopher Pike.
Oh, I love hearing that. I was such a big Christopher Pike fan when I was in those middle school and early high school into high school years. Oh my gosh. They were also like so gripping. And I think he really did use like the genre elements to talk about what it was like to kind of like be young, like in that time period.
Did you have a favorite?
I really like the Remember Me ones.
Okay, I series was so good.
So let's talk a little bit about The Darkness Rises and Whitney. She has a really she's a very internal character because she's going through a lot and there, she's hiding a lot. So could you talk a little bit about a little bit more about like the nature of this what you might call either a gift or a terrible burden and how it affects how she moves through the world.
When she first discovers that she has this gift, she's seven, and her grandma has the same gift. And before she started seeing the dark clouds, her grandma, who she calls Gams, warns her, "Hey, this may or may not happen. If it ever happens, don't tell anyone else. Just tell me." And what she learns from her grandma is her grandma, who grew up seeing these clouds, people don't understand things like this. People are afraid of things they can't understand. And if you talk to people about this, they will be afraid of you. So we have to keep this a secret. So she's told she has to keep this thing a secret. And her grandma also really warns her, hey, it can be dangerous to save people. There are consequences. But of course, Whitney doesn't listen. She feels compelled. If I can save people, of course, I'm going to save people. And so her grandma writes out these rules for her to follow to help her. So protect her in a sense. And for the most part, Whitney follows them, but sometimes she just can't help herself because she wants to save people. So when we meet Whitney in the book, she's at this place of being torn from feeling this, I have this ability to save people. Shouldn't I save people? But then she's learned this lesson that her grandma tried to teach her very early on that there are consequences to saving people because the person that Whitney has saved, there were horrible consequences and, a horrible tragic event that happens because she saves this one kid. And so the whole book, she's wondering, what if I'd never saved him? Maybe saving people is bad. Maybe there's a butterfly effect. So you feel this push-pull of who she was and just her being her nature, wanting to save people and realizing that there are consequences. So that becomes a big theme of that split in half version of Whitney. But at its core, I actually think she's just a person who is going through it. She has suffered a trauma. She blames herself. And so she's isolated herself. And it takes basically the whole book for her to really learn the lesson of you shouldn't isolate yourself. We all go through it. We have people that love us, that are around us, that want us to be happy. And in fact, the whole book, her best friend is just trying to say, talk to me, share with me. I need somebody to talk to too. And it takes her a long time to learn that lesson. So I share that because there's one tension caused by the magical power, right, around the being split into what's the good and bad. But then there's just this human underlying lesson of you got to talk about things that you're going through with the people who care about you. And I think a lot of times we all feel that at some point in our lives, that need to hide what we're really feeling, to be present for others and not be present for ourselves. So I find every time I write a book, there's usually something about me that gets pulled in there, whether intentional or not. And I certainly resonate with that. I have a daughter, a husband, a dog, a job, lots of, people in my life. And there's this tendency to care for others and not care for yourself. And I think some of that ended up on the page as I was, processing myself and my life and my own personal journeys.
Absolutely, because it's so tempting, and it's a double-edged sword to like prioritize other over yourself, because like on the one hand you are ignoring yourself, but it's also like letting yourself off the hook of doing the hard work of taking care of yourself in a weird way. And I think that's particularly poignant for where Whitney is in her life. Like, she's a senior as well, and I think that just overlaps with like her coming to terms with like her powers having consequences that she doesn't intend. And how like at that phase of life, you're like on the precipice of adulthood, you're about to gain a whole bunch of like agency and responsibilities that you didn't have to worry about before. And like really gr like grappling with having responsibility means that like you are accountable for your actions and your choices. And like that's such a hard phase to go through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Could you talk a little bit about the family dynamics, because I really did love the dynamics between Gams and Whitney as well. And I think it has so many interesting things to say about family legacies and like the things that we inherit from our forebears, whether we really like want to or not. So could you talk a little bit about crafting that dynamic, and also maybe how dance plays a role? Because I was really interested in like it's not just the gift or burden of this like power, but also like the love of dance. And maybe like I've always kind of thought of like dance as sort of next to magic anyway, like could you talk about all those like connections?
I love that dance being next to magic. Yeah, I was a dancer growing up. I was terrible at sports, but at an early age, I found dance, and that was my thing all the way really through college. I danced competitively. In the book, I call it dance team just because that is more universal. In Texas, it would actually be called the drill team. I did not call it the drill team because in certain states, drill team usually means like maybe the flag corps or other, it has a lot of other meanings. But in Texas, where I grew up, you are a member of the dance team for your high school, and you perform at your halftime games, then you do competition during the spring. So a lot of it was my experience because that was just such an important part of my high school experience. I was all in it. It really does become this all-consuming love of waking up in the morning, going to practice, practicing after school, preparing for those big routines. So that was a little bit of my love letter to that experience. And then also you get to see it being pulled away from Whitney. And so you see the sadness of leaving it. And I remember graduating from college and kind of being like, wow, am I ever going to dance again? And you tell yourself you will, but it's hard to continue with some of those hobbies that we get so steeped in high school unless you decide to pursue it professionally. So there was a little bit of that in there too. So I'm so glad that piece resonated with you because that was deeply personal, and I've always wanted to write a book that included dance in it. And then to touch on Gams, the relationship there, Gams is sort of her role model. She grew up in her grandmother's dance studio that started her love of dance, and her grandma was actually a professional ballerina. So she is involved heavily in the high school level of it, but inspired by this woman who toured around the world and danced, and whose home is covered in playbills of all of her time in dance. So she very much looks up to her grandma. She's probably the closest person in her life, both in they share this love of dance and they share this secret. And it seems to skip a generation because Whitney's mom is not a dancer. She is not, she does not see the darkness. So it's almost like this gift, the secrets that the two, her, Whitney and her grandma get to share together. And also the person that she feels like most understands her in her life.
Yeah, it's really poignant, and I think they work so well together, like the dance and the magic too, because Whitney's at this moment, where like both of those things sort of like gave her like pride and joy up to that point, you know, and were like pretty central to her identity. And at the same time, like both those things are ripped away from her, or the joy anyway that they sort of like gave her, and they become a lot more complicated and a lot less I guess a lot less like pure happy experience, you know, in a way. And that speaks to a, yeah, this time of your life where like you're going to trade in all of these passions and interests for like the structure of college and then for a job and all of that. Like it's, yeah, I spend so much time thinking about that period of life, and I just I really love the exploration of it here.
Oh yeah, thank you again. It sort of creeps in. I find that with every book, there's all these little pieces of myself that creep in, whether I'm intentionally doing it or not. And actually, I think most of the time I'm not intentionally doing it. I just finish the story and look backward and be like, oh, I was kind of writing a love letter to dance, or oh, I was processing this fill in the blank thing for myself. In this book, there's a number of different things that I'm in hindsight processing on the page.
I'd love if you could talk a little bit about Penny. And, you know, to go back to dance a little bit, like I'm really interested too in this sort of like really strict hierarchy, like the social hierarchy involved in these teams, as well as like the sort of like occasionally very aggressive competition, you know, and how there is that sort of like darker edge to like the sort of like sociology of the dance team too. Yeah, could you talk a little bit about exploring those dynamics? Because like in a lot of ways too, this is about like healthy teen female friendships and really unhealthy ones too.
Right. Yeah. No, this is another very real thing. And the one hand with being on the dance team, or as we called it in my area of the country, the drill team, you're a team, right? You're dancing together, you're performing together. But then there are these individual components of it. So, will I make the routine? There's only so many people that can make each number, and not everybody gets to be it. Where will I be? Will I be in the front row? Will I be in the back row? There are solos during competition that people are competing head to head. And then there, for those who want to be an officer in the dance team, you have to audition for that. There's only one captain. I was actually an officer in the dance team, and so a lot of those tensions I experienced with these girls, women who were very much my friends, but then there were these sharp-edged moments. I remember distinctly competing against each other for solos, and it was all fun and games until two of us got picked to be finalists and perform at the end of the competition, and one of us, who was in fact the captain at the time, did not. And that was sort of this very dramatic thing that led to some infighting among all of us. So all of that very much happens, that tension of you're together, but then you're also separate. And for the group, like the Whitneys and the Pennies, who are really the top performers, they're always competing for those top moments to be the one that's front and center, to be the one who's number one. So that was very much based on my own experience. I don't know about other dance teams in the country, but again, in Texas and in the South, when you compete, it is intentionally very hierarchical, so much so that you have to hold the door open first for anybody who is more senior. So when we were walking into, say, like the locker room, the doors would get open. The captain goes first, then the lieutenants, then the junior lieutenants, then the seniors on the team. So there is very much this structure that is embedded too, that adds, I think, a little bit of attention. Too. I am the captain. You felt that with the Penny relationship between Penny and Whitney, because Whitney was supposed to be captain and then she drops off the team. So now Penny is. So I think there's also this like, am I good enough to be captain tension with Penny, and the competition still lingers even though Whitney's no longer on the team.
Yeah, my gosh, it does sound really stressful. And you know, and I was thinking too about how like let's see, how do I phrase this? Like Penny is so aggressive, but she's also extremely vulnerable, right? Like there is this sort of like tension between like, you know, if you need to insist that you are the best that hard, like you probably actually have some doubts about that yourself. You know.
Yeah. And she definitely has a chip on her shoulder about coming in second, right? She became cat. She's the top of the pyramid now, but only because Whitney's not. She's dating Whitney's ex-boyfriend, but only because she dumped him. So I think she's got a massive chip on her shoulder. But then at the same time, I think she is a human flawed character because she tries so hard and works so hard and she never quite gets there. And that does something to you as a person when you're a hard worker and there's just this person who doesn't seem to have to work as hard to get the things that you want so much. So even though Penny is very clearly not a good guy in the story so much as I think she wants to be, I think she also is, that she's a sympathetic human person who's trying her best to be the best she can be, never quite gets there. That's frustrating.
Yeah, it does tread like a really nice line of sympathy with her, where you definitely like don't really enjoy a lot of her interactions and how she treats Whitney, but like you do sort of because you understand where it comes from, you're like, okay.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So it's fun writing villainous characters, but I think it's important that they seem human. Otherwise, you can come across as very caricaturey. And the more interesting villains are the ones where you actually get a little peek into who they are as a person and what their motivation is.
Absolutely. So in general, I've been trying to be super vague about the plots and the various twists and turns. So I'm going to ask a question, that and you can give as vague an answer as you like to this. But when you were plotting out the story, did you have a really clear idea of where you were going to end up, or did the story sort of reveal itself to you as you began?
A little bit of both. And this is sort of a bad habit of mine that I'm working on fixing because I think I would write so much faster if I could fix it. I tend to be more of a pantser, but I will have some beats that I know are going to happen. So I did know from the onset who the perpetrator was, but their motivation and what shape that took changed many times throughout the drafts of the story. I had a couple of scenes that I knew were going to happen. There, chapter two, which is a flashback to when Whitney first gets to see the darkness. That was actually initially the opening to the book. That chapter has remained largely unchanged outside of a few details. The reveal where you get to go to the football game and experience what happened, that is pretty similar to the very first draft that I wrote. Like I always knew I was writing up to a scene like that, although there's some things around it that shifted and changed. But otherwise, it's kind of these beat moments. And then me meandering to figure out how can I get there. And I will say probably the thing that changed the most, and I don't think this is a giveaway because it's in the back of the book. The thing that happens is ultimately Whitney saves this boy and he goes on to the school and there's a school shooting as a result of it. That piece is revealed in the back copy. And also there's some trigger warnings because that is a pretty touchy topic. And I want to make sure people know from a content standpoint that that's in the book. But that piece of it was not part of the original draft of the book. That actually happened because there was a school shooting. It was in the news. And I talked about how I kind of unintentionally process things. That was very much me processing all of this stuff that was going on in the world. Because I just, you'll read this in my author's note when I talk about where did that come from. There was all this news about a horrible school shooting, and I found myself changing the channel and stopping because I'm like, I don't want to listen. Nah, not again. You start to have this attitude of like, oh, another one, where you're almost becoming like callous and complacent to it. And there was this pause moving about, what am I doing? I'm a mom with a kid, and I realized I just didn't want to understand what was happening in the world and to realize the reality. So a lot of that made its way on the page of me processing, and a lot of Whitney's grief about what happened and her guilt about what happened is actually my own sort of grief and guilt in dealing with all of those things.
Yeah, it's handled really sensitively and very touchingly. And I did wonder if that was, sort of something that emerged over this sort of like long drafting period. Yeah, it's just a really beautiful book, and I think it handles so many like really tough things really beautifully. And thank you for coming to talk about it with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're so welcome. Listeners, heads up, you're going to check out The Darkness Rises. It is so good. When you hear this, it will be out in the world. So go to your favorite independent bookstore or library. You won't regret it. All right, thank you so much for joining us, listeners. It is now time to close this chapter.
it's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.